ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, I'm Clint Jasper, and you're listening to A Big Country. Thanks for joining me. This week, we're visiting a small town where the community has spent a decade working to preserve their unique history by restoring a heritage-listed 130-year-old butter factory. We'll meet the female farm workers who are the first from the Pacific Island nation of Bougainville to find jobs on Aussie farms. And we're heading to Australia's longest jetty where a freediver is helping tourists and locals recover items accidentally dropped into the sea. But to do so, he's had to overcome a crippling fear of the ocean.
It was almost to a point where the phobia of the ocean was impacting on my life. Like, I couldn't hang out with friends at the beach. I couldn't swim for recreation. And now I have all that back.
How getting back into the water has allowed Peter to help others. That's coming up. First today, we're off to northwest Tasmania to a special patch of land near the town of Burnie. It's where centuries of Aboriginal land management with fire have created unique ecosystems full of rare species. The current managers, a timber plantation company, still use those techniques to maintain the landscape, but say climate change is making it harder than ever. Meg Powell has the story.
I'm standing in the middle of an ancient lava flow where the rich soil and the chilly Tasmanian air should be producing cool temperate rainforest, but it's not. It's actually a button grass plain. It looks a bit like a meadow or a park surrounded by thick bush. And researchers say it exists because of thousands of years of Aboriginal burning.
We assume they burnt it for hunting purposes, obviously to keep areas open so they could travel through that environment.
This is Adam Crook. Adam works for Forico, the forestry company that now manages the land.
Burnt on a regular basis. Well, if we didn't burn, we would eventually lose the grassland. So we're just to the side of Finger Post, which is off the Ridgely Highway, Waratah Road. We're in a grassland that's approximately 345 hectares in size. We're surrounded by Delicatensis, dry forest with a grassy woodland understory. And then to the side of that forest, we're now in button grass plain.
I might be wrong here in this guess, but is this the kind of area that explorer Henry Hellyer looked at and thought this would be perfect for sheep?
Quite possibly. I know he certainly did at Peak Plain and a few other grasslands. I'm sure he certainly looked at this one and introduced sheep, but we all know that didn't do particularly well.
So now, well, there's no sheep here, obviously. There's the occasional dead wallaby that we've seen and some eagles swooping around. Yep. But what is this land actually used for? Is it purely just a conservation area?
Yep, purely conservation. So there's a lot of high conservation values in here. These are super unique, these grasslands in the Surry Hills Estate. So unique that they've got conservation covenants on them. That's how important they are. And, yeah, they provide habitat for rare and threatened orchids, Tanara brown butterfly, just to name a few.
Over time, those threatened species have come to rely on low-intensity, high-frequency burns, which Adam says he continues to do with input from Tasmanian Aboriginals.
So we engage with the Aboriginal community. We get them involved in the burning. Obviously, there's a science to putting in a burn of this sort of size, but we try and mimic how they would have lit in the past. But, you know, there's ways that we have to light to make it safe. Yeah, it's definitely a new space, and we've put on an Indigenous cadet forester in the last 12 months, and I've been mentoring Aaron, and he's loving the exposure he's getting to being involved with grassland burning and just getting on country and improving the landscape.
Vegetation expert Dr. Magali Wright works to protect some of the plants found in this area and says the fire is important in maintaining biodiversity.
If you have a look around here, you can see that the grasses are in tussocks and then there's spaces between the tussocks, and that's where we see the orchids and some of the other herbs and things that are important parts of the biodiversity. So in a tussock grassland, if you don't burn, or grazing can be used as well, but maybe not quite as effectively as burning, the tussocks end up taking over and there's no spaces between the tussocks. And that's where that biodiversity of orchids and other herbs get pushed out.
But timing is everything. Underneath these tussocks is peaty soil, which is really good at burning, actually, but somehow it's not burning when we're setting these big fires. What's going on?
Again, it's all about timing. So the burning will be taking place at a time that there's enough moisture in the peat to avoid it catching fire. So, you know, here where you're doing ecological burning, it's to maintain the diversity between the tussocks too, but also, reducing the fuel load, so to avoid the risk of a catastrophic wildfire. So if you had a fire go through here in the summer, you can imagine the peat igniting, and it just continues to burn. So there's a lot of stored carbon loss if that happens.
So generally spring with our grassland burning, we want obviously enough moisture in the surrounding forest to create a bit of a fuel moisture differential that I talked about before. So it acts essentially as a fire break, right? You light when the surrounding forest is wet, the fire reaches that point and then self-extinguishes. You can actually burn this grassland when there's knee-high deep water in here. Yeah, but we've walked across it now. It's super soft. You know how much moisture's in here.
But Adam says that window of opportunity has been getting smaller.
We haven't done much burning this season. It's been particularly dry, abnormally dry. Normally, you know, we would have conducted, you know, 10 to 15 burns at this point, upwards of 500-600 hectares. In a big year, we might do 1,000 hectares of grassland burning. Yeah, so I've seen it, like in the last 5 years, how that window is getting smaller and smaller every year. You know, this is the first time in 10 years that I haven't been able to do much burning in spring. Yeah, it's going to make things a lot harder, isn't it? We're going to be restricted in how many burns that we can do and when we can do them. We might have to revert to a bit more autumn burning, but obviously the season's dragging on longer too, isn't it?
Try make a plant a little one that now.
On this large-scale nursery just outside of Deloraine in Tasmania's north, about a dozen women are working their way up and down the rows of tall blackberry canes. Hello, I'm Larissa Smith, and I'm meeting these women who are working here taping the canes together so they can be distributed to other farms to grow out. What's so special about this workforce is they're from Bougainville, a series of islands east of Papua New Guinea and northeast of Australia. And they're some of the first women from Bougainville to take part in the Pacific Australia Labour Mobility Scheme, also known as PALM. Team leader on this farm is Carol Neverui.
It's all about, you know, using our eyes and getting things done properly.
As the team leader of the 10 girls here, the main role I do as a team leader, I usually report the end of every month to PNG LMU, Labour Mobility Unit. Yeah, so every end of the month or 2 weeks, I send in report how we are doing and stuff like that, if we needed help, support.
How have these women adjusted?
I've learned to live away from home. And when I came here, it was just like any other time I left home to go to another community or something like that. And also, because I have there's a time frame for me to be here, like I always count down. So it's really okay for me. But I don't know about the other girls. It's been like 4 months now. And yeah, I don't really miss so much. Yeah. But I'm thinking of coming back if everything goes well.
What would you like to spend the money on that you've earned here?
I send some money back home to my parents and for school fees for my younger brother, the last one in the family. And I'm saving up for some plans higher for myself. It's been a good experience for me.
Hello, my name is Lilian Paisabua. I come from Papua New Guinea, up in the highlands of Papua New Guinea, the coldest place in PNG, and it's Enga province.
As cold as here?
Yep, similar to Tasmania's weather. So I've got 3 kids to look after. That's why I quit my job. I used to work as a logistic coordinator for Papua New Guinea Institute of Medical Research. Yeah, based in Eastern Highlands, Goroka. Big change. But it's good too because I'm also a subsistence farmer. I used to work to sell food at the market, farmer's market, in order to put food on the table for the kids, yeah, for the children.
And what were you growing?
It's just basically taro and cassavas, sweet potato and veggies, yeah.
What do you enjoy most about being out here?
It's really amazing to have come this far because at first I was, 3 of us, we were in the horticultural in Queensland, and then we had to transfer here. We normally do veggies, harvest veggies back in Queensland for the rugby farm before we travel to do strawberries. And it's kind of a new field that we are getting ourselves in, and we've gotten used to it already. So we've been here 3 months and we've got 2 more months before we head back home. So it's really a great opportunity to be here working with you know, ladies that come from different cultural backgrounds that are not same as the 3 of us come from.
How important is it that women have come out on this crew?
I think it's good experience for them because most of them are very young and probably can't afford to pay for their school fees, or could be a reason that they have to look after their old ones or maybe siblings. And this opportunity is it's like a given on a golden plate. Some of us are thinking of going back home and talking with our provincial government to, as we can try and trial this program out back in the country, in the province that we come from, maybe do a partnership with the landowners, with the provincial government and all this, and maybe the skills that we acquired whilst here in Australia, we can try and use it back at home for the good of the country, the community, the province, and also for the country as a whole. And you know, that will be good because it's gonna be we're gonna create job opportunities for unfortunate people who can't find job elsewhere.
The PNG government has set a target of signing up 8,000 people for the PALM scheme by 2025. Farm manager here at Deloraine Cane's, Tim Creswell, says their current crew of Bougainvillean women have been a big asset to their workforce.
Well, if we couldn't access labour through Hillwood Berries, we wouldn't be able to run the enterprise that we're running here because we just can't get Australian workers, just either not interested or that it's too easy to sit at home. We've tried and tried with local workers and local labour, but just no one wants a job.
And specifically working on the canes?
Look, if we found some good people that willing, you know, they'd get a large variety of work. It's not just so much working on the canes, like the boys that we've got here who are Tongan boys. You know, they're doing planned husbandry. They're also into doing all their maintenance jobs. But at times of year when I need them, they'll drive tractors with haul-out trailers when we're digging carrots and other bits and things as required. 2 of our main boys, they're prison guards back home, and this is their first taste of agriculture and horticulture anywhere in the world, and they're loving it, and they've both said that they want to go home and buy a bit of land, or they love the opportunity because they don't get these opportunities back home. These girls are very good workers and they're very proactive.
And so you'd be happy to have them back?
Oh, in a heartbeat. We're very happy with all our workers that we've got from other countries, all our island labour. They're here to work and they want to be here and they love it here. They, all the time they say to you, we love it here, we want to stay, we want to come back. You know, so that's good for us that we know that we're being kind to them and they're enjoying being here.
Nursery manager Tim Creswell from Deloraine in northern Tasmania, ending that story from Larissa Smith. You'll find more on that story and all of the stories on the program by heading to the ABC website, abc.net.au. Search for A Big Country to find our program page. I'm Clint Jasper with you for A Big Country. Still to come, how a community of volunteers transformed a derelict old butter factory into a beautifully restored building that's become a place for meetings and celebrations. And we're meeting freediver Peter Wissink. He struggled with a crippling fear of the ocean after his father died. Now he's known around the WA town of Busselton as the man who saves people's precious items when they're accidentally dropped off Australia's longest jetty. Amelia Searson has the story.
When Peter Wissink dives into the clear blue waters off the Busselton jetty, you would never think that less than a year ago, he was battling an intense fear of the ocean.
It was almost to a point where the phobia of the ocean was impacting on my life. Like, I couldn't hang out with friends at the beach. I couldn't swim for recreation. And now I have all that back.
Growing up, Peter spent a lot of time fishing and swimming with his dad, who was a keen spear fisherman in the Northern Rivers region of New South Wales. But after moving to a landlocked part of South Australia as a teenager and tragically losing his father, Peter developed anxiety. It made him feel scared of the thing he'd treasured so much as a child. It wasn't until last year, when the now 22-year-old moved to the coastal town of Busselton in WA's southwest, that he decided to get back into the water.
I picked up snorkeling. It was terrifying, but for some reason I was incredibly persistent about seeing fish again. And a lot of the times I'll be at the jetty getting ready for a dive and I'll look back to the shore. I'm kind of in shock that a year ago I could barely be in chest-deep water.
The Busselton jetty, where Peter freedives nearly every day, is the longest timber jetty in the Southern Hemisphere, making it a major tourism drawcard for the region. But with more visitors to the jetty comes a greater chance of items being accidentally dropped into the ocean. Recently, a young woman who just finished a jog along the jetty jumped into the water to cool off, not realising her car keys had fallen out of her pocket and sunk straight to the bottom. Luckily, Peter was close by.
I was geared up in like a couple seconds. There was no hassle. And I hopped in, I took a big inhale, dove down to the sea floor. It only took me around 20 seconds of scanning to see this singular key. So I swam over to it and held it up above my head as I was surfacing. And immediately, you could see the relief on her face and cheers from people.
It's not the first time Peter's saved someone's belongings from the ocean's depths. He's retrieved countless watches, AirPods, phones, keys, and drone remotes. Last winter, during rough and windy conditions, he rescued a fishing rod worth about $400.
The second I surfaced with the rod, it's like their outlook on the day completely shifted. They were just over the top of the world.
Peter says being able to relieve people's stress when they drop things overboard has helped him through his own anxiety battles.
I'd almost call it a bit of healing. The fact someone who's lived that can make a change for someone else, for some reason it also gives me a sense of security as well in myself, you know, that I'm worth something.
When he's not saving people's fishing rods and phones, Peter often fills up mesh bags with rubbish from the seafloor. He says seeing the litter fills him with grief.
To you, it's just a piece of rubbish, it doesn't matter, but that'll end up in the stomach of a fish, in the stomach of a stingray or shark, and it just comes down to thinking of the bigger picture.
Sophie Teed is the environment manager at the Busselton Jetty. She also spends a fair amount of time retrieving people's belongings from the ocean.
It actually happens quite regularly, more than you would think. People drop all sorts of things through either through the cracks in the jetty or peering over the edge to have a closer look and their sunnies go over. So it's quite a picturesque location, so phones often slip out of people's hands over the side.
Sophie says while accidents happen, people need to clean up after themselves.
When things are dropped into the ocean, if it's litter, it just stays there. Where it's dropped down, if it's heavy enough to sink to the seabed, that's where it will remain for quite a long time. We do find things that are months or even years old in the ocean. There's lots of stories of candy wrappers washing up on the beach from the 70s and 80s.
For Peter, protecting the underwater world and its marine life helps him feel closer to his dad.
Even before you penetrate the surface of the water, just laying on top, you're surrounded by colours, orange, blue, yellow, green, pink, basically anything you can imagine. But when you progress to the point where you're diving down, the outside world almost shuts off. It's also a place for connection that I don't really feel anywhere else. In the more recent months, as I've improved my free diving, where I'm within inches of fish and I watch them dig in front of my face and hunt in front of me, I'd call it spiritual. I lost my dad when I was 12 or 13, and his connection to the ocean was huge. And to some extent, connecting with animals almost feels like part of me and him at the same time.
On the banks of Lake Alexandrina, near the end of the River Murray in South Australia, the community of Malang has been working for almost 10 years to restore their historic butter factory. Back in the late 1800s, Malang was one of the country's busiest inland ports, with paddle steamers chuffing from across the lake and upriver to offload produce for transport to Adelaide. That's when an enterprising local, Arthur Lipson, built the town's distinctive barrel roof butter factory on a site overlooking the bustling jetty and lake.
There was milk boats that came over across the lake, so that was a regular trade, which docked and brought the milk up here.
Hello, I'm Caroline Horn, and I'm chatting to John Bradford from the Malang and District Community Association.
There was a lot of smaller farms around in those days that had dairies, you know, like most of all the big ones got together and sold up and became bigger farms, and the day of the small cocky with these few cows was over. Especially when the refrigeration things came in. Bulk milk, probably 50s, I would think.
The factory's fortunes went up and down over the years, and it was taken over by Farmers Union in 1919, ending up as a depot before closing in the 1960s. Since then, it's been quietly decaying until 10 years ago, when the Community Association approached the owners of the factory and the adjoining manager's cottage to buy the site. Countless grant applications, barbecues, book sales, concerts, and donated hours of volunteer work later, the finishing touches are now being applied.
It's become a passion, really, and such a great project for the town. I want to see it finished. So do the boys, you know. We've all got this urge to sort of see it right through from the very start, and lucky to have a really good crew that hang around and come every week for volunteer day, like working bee days and fundraising and all sorts of things. So.
If John sounds a little muffled, that's because I've followed him and his wife Karen, who's also been one of the drivers of the project from the start, down into the slightly musty 13-foot cellar under the factory that was originally dug out by hand back in 1893.
So we had it engineered and we had to beef it up with uprights and huge beams and rafters and things like that. So
this would have been where they kept everything cool, I guess.
Yeah, cheese and butter, yeah.
And this is the really interesting things. This is a tunnel that goes underneath the road and into the face of Todd's Hill, across the road.
Oh, really?
And that was used as ventilation and cooling, because at Malang we nearly always get an afternoon sea breeze that comes in. So that was the cooling mechanism for the cellar. The other end of the tunnel has been closed off, a bit of a landslip, and it wasn't a safe place, but there are lots of stories from a few years ago where kids, you know, came in, and we had a really interesting chap call in early in the restoration when we took taken over, and he was at a scout camp here, and a few of them had come in and they stole a wheel of cheese, and he felt guilty about it, like he was in his 70s, I think. He felt guilty about it all his life, so he gave us a donation.
Now, with all the larger engineering jobs done and the manager's cottage already in use by community organisations, the crew is now focused on transforming the old loading dock into a stage and fitting out the former factory for its new life as an event space complete with museum, commercial kitchen and all sorts of possibilities.
Will it be a bit sad when it all finishes?
Yeah, well, people ask me what I'm going to do, so I don't know what, but yeah. Sad, I'll feel fairly relieved and proud, I think, because it has been such a great project and a long one. We had people come and go, but you know, the main crew have stuck with it, and now we've got the cottage open. It's that's one part that's done, and this is so close now that you can taste it. We've got the bookshop there, and the little museum that'll be all set up with a whole range of the gear that we've had left. We'll dress it up and make it look the part. And tell the story. That's the whole deal. It's a great story, and it's only hope gets far and wide.
John Bradford from the Malang and District Community Association in South Australia's southeast. You'll find that story on the ABC website, abc.net.au. Just look for A Big Country. That's the show for today. Thanks for listening and bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.